This is the Unconquered Podcast. Unbiased, unrivaled, and unconquered coverage and analysis of Florida State football.
At Florida State, we won national championships and ACC championships.
Back at some basics,
consistency in what we're doing.
Guys getting more banged than we're working a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success, so you know something, I can really do this.
Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Today on the show, we'll review the Miami game. We'll also look ahead to next week's Wake Forest game. And we're going to take the final segment to evaluate two other really big games for Florida State's future this weekend. The Stanford-Oregon game, which will be played on Thursday, and the Alabama-LSU game on Saturday. So let's go ahead and move into segment one. Looking at the Miami game, it was another dominant performance, despite Florida State really coming out with its C game in this one. Miami really, they did what we expected on defense, what we and several other outlets expected on defense. They learned from previous teams blitzing Winston and getting burned. And in this one, they did very little blitzing. They by and large, brought a lot of max coverage, a lot of seven and eight guys dropping back into coverage and spying Winston some, not really trying to get after him quite as much by bringing extra personnel. A lot of max coverage and you know, basically seeing, they wanted to test to see if Winston, as a young quarterback, and whether this, you know, this offense that's used to a lot of explosive plays, whether they would be patient enough to throw it down the field. Or to not throw it down the field, to run the football, to check down and be patient, and, you know, settle for 9, 10, 12 yard, 12 play drives, as opposed to just, you know, throwing it down the field and getting a lot of big plays. And, you know, if they did force it down the field, then hopefully, you know, from Miami's perspective, hopefully force some turnovers. And you did see a couple of those turnovers happen early on, although I don't think that really that was so much a matter of getting impatient. One of them was a bit of a greedy throw. The latter we'll talk about in a moment, but the second one we'll talk about in a moment. But I think really what we saw from Winston early on was more of a product of him coming out a bit too amped up. When you see the kind of overthrows that he had early on, he had, you know, four, maybe five overthrows, three or four at least, overthrows early on. That's usually an indicator that a quarterback has come out with just a little bit more emotionally charged than normal, and he's just putting a little bit more on the ball and having trouble keeping it down. And every so often you see that happens a little bit more with younger quarterbacks. I mean, Brett Favre, though, is the kind of guy that actually struggled with it his whole career, and so, you know, it is something that happens. It's something that I think you have to expect with a young quarterback periodically. What's remarkable is that despite the fact that Winston came out a bit too amped up, and you could see, by the way, you could see that, you know, a couple times early on when he came to the sideline, you could see Jimbo Fisher getting on him saying, just calm down, just settle down a little bit and get yourself calmed down and just play. And you could see that's the way it works. And I think some of it actually might be a factor that, you know, this was a home game. This was not only a big game, but this was a big game at home. And I think sometimes it actually is more difficult for a quarterback to play this kind of game at home as opposed to on the road. It's sort of paradoxical or, you know, contradictory in compared to the way that a lot of people would think about it. But there's a little bit of a different pressure at home. You really want to impress. You want to perform. And there isn't the kind of me against the world, us against the world kind of mentality that you have on the road that sometimes can actually take the pressure off of a quarterback. And I think in this one, you saw Winston press just a little bit early, be a little bit overly amped up, a little bit more emotionally charged early in this game, and you kind of had to settle down. And what is remarkable, what to me is the most remarkable thing about this game, is despite the fact that Winston came out amped up like that, despite the fact that he, you know, sort of played like a freshman early on, although really still a really good freshman, this offense still put on a dominant performance. I mean, they still averaged over 7 yards a play. You know, their season average is over eight, but they still put on an average. Oh, they averaged over 7 yards a play against a pretty good Miami defense. And the defense was terrific as well. And they only gave up 4.82 yards per play against a Miami team that came in averaging significantly more than that. You know, that's not actually that far above the Florida State's average of giving up 4.28 yards per play on the season, which is, you know, among the leaders in the country. So a very good defensive performance. But basically, by Miami choosing to cover Florida State this way, it basically amounted to a challenge of, you know, will you be patient to run just to run the football? And I think we saw that Florida State was more than patient, more than willing to run the football and play the way that they needed to win that game. I mean, you look at the basic breakdown of this game, and you see. Basically, you know, you see what 73 plays, and of which there were what 44 rushes. So, I mean, that's a pretty high. That's a little over 60% run pass ratio, and you could see that especially in the second half, Florida State decided to just run the football a lot, and it wasn't so much protecting Winston in that case. It was just a matter of if they're going to continue to sit back and play deep and keep dropping guys like that, then we're just going to run it at them. And 44 carries for 192 yards is 4.36 yards per carry. That's a pretty good yard per carry average against a decent defense. There may be some concern that that's not actually higher. I mean, if you want to be dominant, you usually want to average over 5 yards a carry in college. But, you know, when you look at it, the reason that it was 4.36 is because you didn't have a breakaway. That's 4.36 yards per carry without a really long run, which is pretty unusual, and again that just illustrates how dominant Florida State was in this particular game. I mean, when you're averaging 4.5 yards per carry, and your longest run is 21 yards, and that's on Carlos Williams' run in the third quarter, early fourth quarter, second half run. Which was a terrific run where, you know, there are very few big backs that can make the move that he did, where you jump cut and take off to the outside like that. There's very few big backs I've ever seen that can make that play. But actually, he probably should have scored on that. Had he cut inside Kelvin Benjamin's block there, he'd probably scored. But, at any rate, when your longest run is only 21 yards and you're still averaging 4.5 yards a carry or just under, then your offensive line is really dominating that game, and really that's what this game basically boiled down to, is Florida State dominated the game on both sides of the line of scrimmage, and that's why I think if Miami and Florida State play again in the ACC title game, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot different from this game. If anything, I think it's going to be a bigger disparity without Duke Johnson, which it's a very, very sad injury there. Duke is really a terrific player, and he's by all accounts a really good kid, and you never want to see a kid go out like that. But without Johnson, this Miami team is not quite as good. And when you have the disparity up front that you saw in this game, things typically don't change in that second game. A lot of people talk about how it's difficult to beat a team twice. It's usually difficult to beat a team that's pretty close to your equal twice because things revert back to the mean. You don't necessarily get the same breaks that cause you to win in the first game. You're still, pretty close to even odds to winning that second game. So, it's of course difficult to beat a team that's close to equal twice. But if you're that much better than a team on both sides of the ball in the line of scrimmage, you're going to expect this kind of result each time. So, again, going back and considering Winston's two interceptions in this game, both were aggressive throws downfield, and that's sometimes you're going to get that. Sometimes you're going to throw interceptions when you throw downfield the way that Florida State does. This offense has a lot more downfield action than most college offenses do at this point. I mean, they're asking Winston to make reads downfield and to throw the football down the field, and that's part of why they've been so explosive. Both were aggressive throws. The first throw, I think he actually lost sight of the backside safety, and tried to force a ball in there where basically by losing that backside safety, he was able to lead him right into it. The second throw though was a little bit trickier. The second throw was, it was an aggressive throw, maybe a little over aggressive, but that was on a route that it's something like what we used to call a broken arrow route over the middle, where as a receiver, you actually have several different sort of on-the-go reads that you have to make. And because of the way that they'd covered that, there was a seam in the middle of the field that O'Leary probably should have seen and throttled down, or at the very least looked back as he's passing through that zone in the way that this offense works, so that Winston, you know, if Winston wants to hit him there, he just throttles down, settles down, and takes the throw there. We've seen that several times this year. In this case, O'Leary actually read it a little bit differently than Winston did. He actually passed through that seam, passed through the zone, didn't look back, and was running it as an over route effectively to get on the other side of that underneath player, and potentially basically it becomes sort of like a corner that runs that goes across the field, going to the corner, where Winston would throw it almost like a corner on a smash route if he has enough time to do that. But you know, it's just basically boils down to a miscommunication on this sort of thing, and it's the kind of thing where ideally, probably if you're Fisher, if you're looking at that in film, you address that as a, well, you know, O'Leary you need to look back. Winston, you need to make sure that, you know, you're assessing what his body language is. I mean, that's where there's supposed to be some communication between receiver and quarterback on whether he's going to throttle down, that sort of thing. If you don't meet eyes with him, then you don't necessarily make that throw. It's a tricky thing. It's one of those interceptions that I don't think actually was a very bad interception. It's the kind of thing that you're just going to have in this kind of offense, where you have those decisions to make on the fly periodically, especially on the inside there at the tight end position, where most of those decisions actually have to happen. That said, the screen call that scored, which was sort of an extension of the running game there, just further demonstrates Jimbo Fisher's terrific knack for calling screens. He just seems to understand when teams are going to bring the blitz. And a lot of that is just very good film study, very good understanding of tendencies, and understanding when a team is going to bring a blitz from a particular spot or against a particular formation, and then basically how they can gouge it. And actually, they had another screen that was set up just about as well that was incomplete at a different point in the game that might have gone the same way. And it was, again, a very similar situation, similar blitz, similar formation. And it's pretty clear that Fisher and this offensive staff had a good idea of down and distance and formation and how exactly Miami would respond to what they showed there, and had a good plan in terms of being able to gouge them on that little running back screen down the sideline. So, you know, again, it's a good indication of exactly how prepared this staff has been so far this year, basically all year, in terms of being able to isolate what basic tendencies are on defense and have good answers against them. Now, in terms of defense, you know, we talked in the prior podcast that the actual game within the game that was, to me, going to be the most interesting thing here was what the defense would choose to do against Miami's running game. How would they choose to stop Miami's big offensive line and ability to run the ball exceeds anything that Florida State had played in the last couple games with Maryland and Clemson, and whether they would go back to some of the bigger looks that they had, some of the, you know, 5-2 Okey personnel and sets that they had. But in this case, they actually went 4-3 personnel against the bigger sets, and they were in the 3-3-5 personnel with Christian Jones at that outside spot, and usually a 4-2-5 look, you know, with actually an even front and Christian Jones at a sort of hybrid defensive end position. They were in that look almost the entire game. And Miami did make that a little bit easier because they were in three wide a good bit, or they were in, an 11 kind of personnel, basically, where, you know, one tight end and three wide, that sort of thing. And you can match that with the 3-3-5 or 4-2-5 look pretty easily. But when Miami did go to bigger personnel sets, the Florida State typically went 4-3 personnel against it rather than to that 5-2 or 3-4 personnel. What they did is they actually brought in an extra defensive tackle. They'd bring in Niall Lawrence Stample, or they would bring in Jacoby McDaniel or someone like that, and have Christian Jones flex outside as an outside linebacker, sort of on the line of scrimmage again, sort of as a hybrid. It would be almost a 5-2 look at times, and they did go some 4-3 over a good bit, and then they went 4-3 under at other times, where, you know, sometimes the under, if you run under, that has the effect of an odd front, even though you have even personnel, that puts that odd front kind of look for the offensive line out there. but basically they were in 4-3 type personnel with Christian Jones as an outside linebacker against those bigger sets. And you did see some Dan Hicks, for example, at defensive end rather than, you know, at that sort of 5-2 outside linebacker position that they worked early in the year in the second half. So, you know, they would have, for example, one personnel set that I saw early on was Jernigan and Niall Lawrence Stample at two of the defensive tackle positions, with Goldman and Edwards at the defensive ends, along with Christian Jones as a sort of hybrid defensive end linebacker out there along with them, and then the same two linebackers inside. And actually, when it all boils down to it, this looks like a much, much better package against the run than what we saw early in the year. I mean, there's still a lot of beef on the field with those big defensive tackles, essentially with Goldman out there, who has played terrific the last 3 weeks. With Goldman out there, you don't have a whole lot of pass rush from that particular defensive end spot, but you have just a really, really good run stopper and a guy that's going to cause problems for you up front on the offensive line. And he's going to allow running. He's going to allow your linebackers a lot of space to run to the ball. And if you do want to bring a linebacker to fire zone, that sort of thing, bring a fifth rusher, he's going to actually occupy those blockers very well and allow you to bring pressure. So they're able to basically, with that kind of size out there, they're able to really limit teams in the running game a lot better than they did earlier in the year. And you could see the gap control is much better than it's been. You know, they seem much more confident in the ability to go short in the box. They don't necessarily need to bring the extra guy in because they've got so much beef in there. They're able to do that. And again, Christian Jones is so much better on the outside, as we've been saying all year. He's so much better on the outside than he just allows this team to be so flexible and so dynamic because of his presence at that position. But at the same point, it's actually the play of Terrence Smith. It's the development of Terrence Smith at that other linebacker that has allowed this defense to become as dominant as it is. I think the coaching staff knew fairly early that Christian Jones was better on the outside. But the real issue early in the year is that they had to do a lot of experimenting to figure out what their best 11 were. You know, you got to know who those guys are. You've got to know whether you can trust a guy like Terrence Smith, who hadn't played as much. And, you know, after he showed them in those first few early games that he could be trusted on the inside, that he could really play at a high level on the inside, then they were able to move some pieces around and get where they wanted to be. I mean, I'd been told early in the year that the real issue that this defensive staff had, the real concern that they had, was that they just did not feel like they had a difference maker at defensive end other than Mario Edwards. They're a little bit young there. They didn't have a guy that they could really trust at that defensive end spot. And that's why we saw a lot of that 5-2 and a lot of those odd sets, putting those extra defensive tackles out there, but not necessarily trusting a defensive end in an even set to be able to do what you might expect a rush end to do. They didn't feel like they had one of those guys unless it was going to be Christian Green, and they weren't sure they could spare him at linebacker. Well, as it turned out, Terrence Smith at linebacker is better than Christian Jones was at that position, and now you've got Christian Jones at that defensive end position, who is better than anybody else could have been on this team at that spot. So essentially, Terrence Smith improving allowed Florida State to get better at two positions, and essentially that you couldn't have moved Christian Jones without the development of Terrence Smith, and he has allowed this defense to be significantly better. And again, I don't know that there are two better coverage linebackers in the country than Terrence and Telvin Smith. Certainly. The Alabama linebackers would have something to say about that, and I think they're overall probably more versatile, maybe a little better set of linebackers in general. But as coverage linebackers, I'm not sure that they're better than this set. These guys can really move and can really run. They run as well as anybody. I mean, Telvin Smith runs about as well as C.J. Mosley. Now, Mosley, again, is a little bit better, more versatile linebacker overall. But, I mean, I don't think that it's as big a gap as you might expect. At any rate, this team was able to hold Miami to a total of 2.86 yards per carry, which, you know, Miami, their lowest on the season other than the Florida game, had been 4.23 yards per carry against South Florida. And that's a game where they didn't even feel like they needed to run the ball all that much. But you know, basically, aside from the University of Florida game and the Florida State game, this Miami team has run all over everybody. But Florida held them to 1.79 yards per carry. And remember, that's pre all the injuries that Florida had. This is when they still had Easley, and that defense, had all of its teeth. This defense for Florida State managed basically to put a very similar defensive performance out there. I mean, actually, Duke Johnson had 28 yards on his first three carries, and then Miami had a grand total of 55 yards on 26 carries the rest of the game. That's just over 2 yards per carry the rest of the game. So that tells you that once this defense settled in, exactly how dominant they were against the run. And that's something that was a real concern coming into this game. You wanted to see whether they would answer the bell against the run. And I think you saw that. And I think you saw exactly how they'll play the rest of the year and some of the versatility that they have personnel-wise now because of the development of Terrence Smith and because of what they're able to do with Christian Jones on the edge and because they can kind of get guys into more natural positions and use some of that beef on the inside to occupy blockers. This is a very good defense at this point, and I think it's a good defense against just about anything now. It's designed to stop the spread more than anything, and this personnel is flexible and able to do that better than anything else they do. But it's still good against other things. I mean, that's a top 15 Miami offense without a doubt. That's a good offense, and they were able to, aside from those a couple early drives, Miami couldn't move the football, and that says a lot about this defense. So. The next question, though, is bodes for Miami moving forward. I mean, they've got four games coming up with Virginia Tech, at Duke, Virginia, and at Pittsburgh as their final four. If you're a Florida State fan, of course, you're interested on whether or not you're going to get another chance to blow Miami out this year. And you know, it's still very possible. You know, if they beat Virginia Tech, then they are nearly clinched to be in the ACC championship game. And of course, Florida State fans are in the unusual position of almost needing to root for Miami to do well so that, you know, you get a chance to, maybe beat a one-loss Miami team in the ACC championship game. I don't think against that slate, without Duke Johnson, Miami goes undefeated. I think they're going to have their hands full with an embarrassed Virginia Tech team this week. I think Duke can beat them. I think Virginia can beat them. I think at Pittsburgh, they can lose. So, you know, any of those four games are losable. And odds are, I think that they lose at least one of them, and probably two of those games are going to be real threats of losing those games. So, more likely than not, Florida State winds up playing a two loss, maybe even a three loss team in the ACC title game, which that hurts a little bit if you're a Florida State fan. But it's just the reality. And the other thing is that teams have not played very well coming off of Florida State this year. Florida State is a very physical and very big team, and teams have struggled in the game following Florida State. So that'll be something to keep an eye on as far as Miami's concerned going into the Virginia Tech game this next week. All right, in the next segment, we're going to take a brief look at the upcoming Wake Forest game. We won't spend too much time on it because, quite frankly, this game will not be close. Back in a moment. Looking ahead to the Wake Forest game, well, this Wake Forest team wasn't going to beat Florida State with their best receiver, Michael Campanaro, and they're certainly not going to beat them without Campanaro. Campanaro is certainly one of the best receivers in the one of the best players actually in the ACC. He's a guy who has an NFL future in the slot. He understands spacing. He understands how to get open. Understands option routes. You know, all the things that these teams, you know, your Bill Belichick type teams like at the next level. He's going to be a very good player. He's a good prospect for the next level. But without him, that Wake Forest offense really doesn't have any weapons. I mean, you've got Josh Harris at running back. You've got some young receivers who, you know, have some potential moving forward. But in terms of current guys, they just don't have anybody that scares you if you're Florida State right now. They've been really manufacturing what they can. And the biggest problem that they've had on both sides of the ball is up front. It's a small football team. You know, they've had some injury trouble on the offensive line. I mean, one of their best offensive linemen, who would have been their best offensive lineman, Antonio Ford, you know, he broke his leg last year. He's still recovering from that somewhat, still limited by that. You know, they've had this sort of shuffle in and out on the offensive line to get what they want. They're starting some freshmen up there. This is a team that's going to be better within the next couple of years, and they're one of the best coached teams in the ACC for sure. But you know, it's a small team, and they're pretty young, and they're fairly limited in terms of what they do. And you know, I gotta say, the thing, if I'm Wake Forest, the thing that I'm really wanting to make sure that I do in this game is come out with a healthy Tanner Price. You know, they're still fighting for a bowl berth. They still have a possibility if they are able to beat a Duke team. If they're able to beat Duke, if they're able to get a, you know, pull out an upset against Vanderbilt, they still could go to a bowl game. And you know, you're not going to go to a bowl game if you suddenly if your quarterback, who Tanner Price, who's a good player, he's a good player, if he's getting beat up against Florida State and isn't able to finish the season, you know, that's definitely going to keep you from going to a bowl game. So if it's me, I'm just trying to, you know, run the clock again, very much like what if I were Miami this last week. The slower this game goes, the better off Wake Forest is in this. So what I expect them to do is exactly that. They're going to slow the game down. They're going to try to limit it to, you know, 9-10 possessions on the week. What you will see a lot of with them, they've been through several different offensive packages over the course of the year as they've been searching for ways to kind of manufacture what they can without the without any dominant personnel, without any guys that you really, really have to worry about scheming for. Basically, you know, they're gonna try to come out with wide splits, the kind of wide splits that Mike Leach sort of made popular among various spread teams. You know, early in the year, they were trying to return to a more of a, you know, the Wake Forest kind of offense from several years ago, from back in the early 2000s when Grobe first got to Wake Forest, more of an option type look, a little bit more power O based running game. But they just weren't able to do that. It didn't look like Price was quite as comfortable with that, and they couldn't get any push up front on the offensive line with that. And they were averaging, I think, through the first few games, they were averaging around 2 yards per carry, which you're just not going to win very many games if you're doing that. So what they ultimately did, you know, talking with their players, what they were comfortable doing, they went to these extra wide splits to try to force defenses to account for that. To spread defenses out and give the offensive linemen a chance to block guys one on one and basically just push them out and give the quarterback a chance to just step up and step around, and you know, basically that also allows you to spread out, you know, your pass rushers on the outside. They have to run an extra 5-6 yards to get to the quarterback, so it sort of immediately allows you more pass protection against basic pass rushes. Now, you know, it can make you somewhat vulnerable to certain blitz looks, but if you do see those blitzes coming, then you know, you can get a back on that guy. You can get a lineman to slide out and do some things. So generally, you are going to get better pass protection out of these wide split looks. It's a little bit harder usually to run the football, you know, all that successfully out of it. But this team's really not trying to run it that much at this point. What they're trying to do is just slow the game down, widen those splits out, protect the quarterback, and then let Tanner Price make some decisions and get some guys the ball on the edge. And up to this point, it's really been Campanaro that they're trying to get the ball to. It'll be interesting to see how they approach it this next week. But you know, it's not even clear what you're going to get with them aside from that wide split look. They do have a very, very good defensive tackle in Nikita Whitlock, one of the best players in the ACC. He's a terrific football player, a very, very explosive guy. It's going to be interesting to see sort of where he winds up in the NFL, because he's a guy that's too good of a player not to wind up playing pro ball, but he just, you know, he doesn't have a position for the next level, but he's a nightmare for guys to block in college. And it'll be a test for Florida State's interior three, blocking probably the quickest and one of the most explosive defensive tackles in the country. So at any rate, this game, aside from that, there's really just not much to talk about. It basically boils down to whether Florida State comes out interested in this game. And with the way that this team has played so far, you can expect a business-like Florida State to come out and try to put this team away in the first or second quarter. And I think by the third quarter, you're going to start seeing a lot of backups. It should look a lot like the NC State game, actually. Maybe not quite so dominant early on. This team did beat NC State, but I do think that you're going to wind up seeing, you know, something like 35-3 at the half or something like that, if they can even get the three without Campanaro in that first half. With no turnovers, you know, Florida State's probably up 30 at the half, and then, you know, you get one series with your starters, and then you move on. I think ultimately you probably expect something like a 62-10 game or 62-6 game in this particular matchup. All right, well, in the next segment, we're going to go ahead and move on, and we're going to evaluate more interesting games this week. We're going to look at the other front runners in the nation. We're going to look at the Stanford-Oregon game, and we're going to look at the Bama-LSU game, and we're going to assess the possibility that one of those two teams, Oregon or Alabama, may lose this weekend. Back in a moment. Starting with the Stanford-Oregon game, since it's the one that actually is played first, I actually think that this is a real possibility that Stanford could win this game. If you look at some of the more sophisticated and better advanced metrics, you know, like the Football Outsiders F-plus rating, Stanford is actually rated higher than Oregon in those opponent-adjusted ratings, largely because of their defense. And their defense has been terrific this year. And, you know, you look at them in their national rankings, their raw rankings, they're up there. They're one of the best teams in the country. But you wonder why they're ranked so highly in these opponent-adjusted. Well, you look at the offenses that they've played, and they've played some really really, really good offenses. I mean, that Arizona State offense is terrific. The Washington offense that they played is terrific. They've done a good job limiting very good offenses, and they're going to play another very good offense in Oregon this week, and they've done as good a job as anybody limiting good offenses so far this year. So, you know, you look at what they're able to do. They're very good at limiting big plays and forcing you to march down the field, and do so without making mistakes. And that's something that, again, that was their MO against Oregon last year, was to basically force them to march the field with perfect execution all the way down and live in the red zone and force Oregon to potentially kick some field goals. And that's a recipe to beat Oregon, and they were able to do it last year. Now, you know, the question is whether or not they can do that now, having just lost their redshirt senior defensive end Ben Gardner, who is third on their team and with 7.5 tackles for a loss. So, I mean, that's a huge loss, because, I mean, he's one of those guys that can help set the edge. He's able to, you know, force Oregon wide, and he's one of the reasons that offense has been so dominant. But, you know, they've got other guys out there. They're a very physical defensive front, even without Gardner. The big issue is, the question is depth. Do they start to wear down on the defensive front without Gardner up there? But, you know, either way, their defense is terrific. And what they're able to do, because they're so good inside, and because they have such disciplined linebackers, and they're able to force Oregon to combo block them and not be able to get to the second level, they're basically able to force Oregon wide a lot. And Oregon's offense, you know, this is the thing that a lot of people don't understand about Oregon's offense. It's a spread offense, but that spread offense is designed to run it straight at you. They want to run inside zone. They want to run some version of an inside zone read and get it to a running back on that inside zone as often as possible and just run it straight down your throat. They want to spread you out and then run it straight down your throat. And if you're a team like Stanford that has defensive linemen and has linebackers that can run, and you saw this to some extent with UCLA early in the game, if you've got the personnel that can actually handle that inside, then it forces Oregon a little bit out of their comfort zone. They want to be able to just run it straight at you, and everything else that they do sets up off of that. If you can force them wide, then you know they're not as fast as they are. They're not nearly as effective, and they don't have the kind of downfield passing game to stretch the field that you know vertically the way that a Florida State does with the Jameis Winston. That said, this is why I'm not so confident that Stanford is able to do the same thing this year that they were last year. In addition to the Gardner injury, Oregon is better offensively in terms of their vertical passing game than they were last year. Mariota has improved as a passer downfield. They've got a little bit more in the offense on that because of how much more they trust him this year than they did last year. And last year, you know, basically Stanford was able to force Oregon wide on a lot of things and take away those bubbles as well, because they have good defensive personnel in the secondary. And Mariota was not able to challenge them downfield, and Oregon didn't have the wide receivers really to challenge Oregon or to challenge Stanford downfield, and be able to get big plays against, you know, basically the Stanford taking away their tendencies. So that's something that I think may be a difference in this year's game. The question is, how much has Oregon improved in that department? You know, is a guy like Huff, or you know, is he better downfield this year than he was last year? I mean, do they have guys that can threaten you downfield, that can threaten Stanford downfield, or is Stanford able to still lock in and do what they did last year? Is Mariota better, you know, that much better enough down the field than he was last year? And my suspicion is that you know, this is not going to be a game in the teens. This is going to be a game probably in the 20s, in the mid to high 20s, because I think Oregon is better equipped to be able to counter what Stanford's able to do, and they'll probably have a big play or two in this game, unlike last year where the biggest play they had was actually a Mariota run, a scramble down the field. The other thing is that Oregon is also better defensively right now than they were last year. Last year, they came into this game very banged up late in the year. They were hurting at the safety position. They were hurting a little bit up front. They'd lost a couple guys to injury. And this year, I think they're coming in fairly healthy. It's been a healthy team so far. They're not nearly as banged up as they were last year, and I think that's going to be a factor as well. That said, you know, Stanford is much more explosive at the wide receiver position than they were last year. They're able to throw downfield. They're, you know, both receivers are averaging 15 plus yards per catch. Hogan is averaging over 12 yards per completion. You know, they're able to stretch you a little bit more than they were last year. But that has come at the cost of what they were able to do last year. That was one of the things that helped them against Oregon so much. They had a couple tight ends last year, Ernst in particular, who is so good. They had that matchup edge because of those tight ends last year, that they were able to stick out there and force you to go big personnel and still be able to throw a little bit to those tight ends. They don't have that quite that this year, and that's actually cost them a lot in the running game. I mean, you talk about the loss of their starting running back from last year. I don't think that's actually the bigger loss here. I think that the tight ends from last year were better than they are this year, and that's actually been where I think there's been a bigger difference between last year's and been at the tight end position. I just don't think that they've been able to get the same kind of production in blocking and sealing the edge in the running game, and they certainly don't scare you nearly as much down the field in the passing game as they did last year. So even though they're getting big plays from the receivers, even though they're able to do that stuff, the biggest difference is that they're 53rd in rushing S&P plus, which is a measure of rushing efficiency, and that for a team that wants to run as their bread and butter, they don't run the football nearly as well as they have in the past few years, and that's bound to be a factor in this game. They're going to have to run the ball better in this game if they're going to win. And it's certainly possible that they beat Oregon. I mean, this coaching staff knows how to scheme against Oregon. They've had success against Oregon in the past. This personnel, it's an experienced team. They've had success against Oregon, so it's possible. But you have to favor Oregon in this game, even though it's at Stanford. I think, you know, if Stanford, you know, if they play this game 10 times, Stanford probably wins, you know, 6.5 or 7 times out of 10. But now the next game is the Bama and LSU game. And I think this one's actually probably more likely to wind up knocking Bama out than Oregon is to get knocked out by Stanford. I think either game, though, is possible. But Bama, the interesting thing is that Alabama hasn't played anybody since their first couple games that can really challenge where Bama has holes. And this Bama team does have holes. And LSU actually does have the ability to pick on a couple of those holes. I mean, LSU also has some weaknesses and some flaws, without a doubt. I mean, this LSU defense is not nearly as good as it's been in the past. It's about the 50th best in the country, as opposed to the fixture in the top 5 or 10 that they've been so far this decade. But, you know, they still have personnel, and I think the biggest thing is that with Ego Ferguson, with those guys on the inside, the defensive tackles that LSU has, that's the biggest threat to Bama that they've got. That, you know, Bama's offensive guards and center early in the year, they showed some weakness there. Now, they've certainly got better as the season has gone along, but they're not the dominant group that they had last year at those positions. And I've been interested to see whether or not LSU's defensive tackles are able to cause some problems on the inside and make McCarron a little bit uncomfortable throwing downfield. And that's something, you know, he does not like pressure in his face. You know, he's not comfortable with that. He doesn't move all that well. He does not like it. He's not used to and is not like, does not like getting pressured from in his face. And, you know, some guys, a guy like Jameis Winston, you bring pressure in his face and he may burn you. A guy like McCarron, he just doesn't like it. You saw that against Virginia Tech in particular early in the year. And LSU has the defensive tackles to do the same kind of thing that Virginia Tech was able to do. The question is exactly how much better Alabama's defense or offensive line actually is. The other matchup where LSU has an edge is LSU's wide receivers versus Alabama's secondary. I mean, aside from D. Milner last year, you know, who was a top 10 pick, aside from D. Milner, this Alabama coaching staff, they've not really liked their corners the last couple of years. And you saw them get exposed last year against Texas A&M. You saw them get exposed this year against Texas A&M. This secondary is not as strong as Bama's secondary has been in the past. They also don't have guys at the safety position that are especially good cover guys. And LSU has a couple of the best wide receivers in the country. In particular, you know, Odell Beckham Jr. And Jarvis Landry. Now, once you actually get past those two guys on the roster, you know, they don't actually have all that much that scares you. Their next receiver, I mean, you've got Odell Beckham Jr. with 48 receptions for over 1,000 yards already on the year. He's averaging over 20 yards a catch. You've got Landry with 58 receptions for 882 yards. He's averaging 15 yards a catch. And then the next guy, you know, 48 catches and 58 catches, and the next guy on their receiving list on the year has 9 catches, and that's Jeremy Hill, their running back. And then, you know, beyond that, you've got Kadron Boone, he's a senior receiver, with 6 catches. You know, their tight end has 4 catches. They just don't have a whole lot of weapons other than Beckham Jr. and Landry. But those guys against Alabama's corners, question is whether or not they're able to cause enough problems, whether LSU is able to force Alabama into one-on-one matchups against those corners and cause Alabama to have some problems there. And, you know, LSU's receivers won those matchups last year in a game that really LSU probably should have won. And you saw Mettenberger that was the best game that he had last year. He had not played nearly as well prior to the Bama game last year. But against Bama's secondary, against what Bama likes to do, LSU matched up quite well last year. So, and this LSU offense is better than LSU's offense was last year. So I think this game is closer to a toss-up. You still favor Alabama a little bit. It's at home. You figure Alabama's probably a little bit more likely to win this game, even though there are some matchups that do fall on the on the side of LSU. But that said, even if you've got Oregon with, let's say, 70% likely to win their game and Alabama 60% likely to win their game, it's still a 58% chance that this weekend one of those two teams loses. The nature of compound odds, you take the 0.7 times the 0.6, and that's the likelihood that both actually win. And I think that's something that, you know, if you asked Florida State fans at this point early in the year, okay, let's say going into this weekend, into this particular weekend, you have a 58% chance of being in the top two in the BCS for the rest of the season. Would you take that? I think most Florida State fans would say yes, absolutely. And either way, I think Oregon looking forward, even if they do not beat, or even if they do not lose this game against Stanford, they still have a road game against Arizona. They still have Utah, who has had some injuries that have banged them up since the Stanford game, so they're not quite as much of a threat. And then they probably, and then they've got the Civil War with Oregon State, and then they probably are going to play a very good Arizona State team in the Pac-12 title game. So, I mean, this is a team that is unlikely. I would peg them at about 20% likely to actually win out. So Florida State's sitting in good position right now. Now, we'll have a much better idea at the end of this weekend where Florida State actually sits moving forward. But I see no reason to be all that panicked just yet if you're a Florida State fan that this is a Florida State team that may be the best team in school history, honestly. At this point, you've got to start thinking that way. This team, I think, personnel-wise, is the closest thing that I've seen in person to 2001 Miami. There are very few teams that I've ever seen in college football that can make the claim that they have among the top position groups in the country at nearly every position, maybe the top position group at four or five positions. It's a dominant team. If you're a Florida State fan, there's no reason at this point to worry too much, because I think that as the chips fall, it's more likely that Bama or Oregon lose against their remaining schedule than that they both win out. I think that's the main takeaway as we move forward. There's still a better chance that one of those two teams loses this weekend than that they both win. So end of the day, this is going to be a very interesting weekend. Even though Florida State plays a team that they should really wallop, this is going to be a very interesting weekend of scoreboard watching and watching the opponents. Watching your competition for Florida State fans. Anyway, let's go ahead and wrap it. That is it for us on behalf of the rest of the Knoll Digest crew. And we're going to have a little bit more of a breakdown of some of these games on Knoll Digest very shortly. On behalf of the rest of the Knoll Digest crew, I'm Jason Staples. This has been the Unconquered Podcast. Thanks for being with us. I made this.